Almighty God, we give thanks for the blessings which have been bestowed on us. Laying aside all personal interests, we acknowledge the Queen and pray for guidance in our deliberations that we may conduct the affairs of this house with wisdom, justice, mercy and humility for the welfare and peace of New Zealand. Amen. No papers or select committee reports have been presented. No bills have been introduced. A petition has been delivered to the clerk for presentation.
Petition of Christopher McDonald requesting that the House of Representatives pass legislation to improve school bus safety.
That petition stands referred to the Petitions Committee. We come now to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by her statement from yesterday, quote, "Of course, our goal is to vaccinate as many people as possible, as quickly as possible," end quote. If so, has her goal changed from April, when she said, quote, "I support the fact that we have been later in the pecking order," end quote?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I stand by my full statements, yes, and no, my goal hasn't changed. Our goal has always been for everyone in New Zealand to be vaccinated as soon as possible. That is why the government established its Vaccine Strategy Task Force in May of 2020 and began conversations with Pfizer in July of 2020. This was long before it was even known if a vaccine could work. The outcome has been agreements with four different manufacturers who have all demonstrated effective vaccines and a decision by our government to focus on the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. But, Mr. Speaker, we've also been aware of the global context we've been operating in, and that will have impacted on distribution and supply across the course of this pandemic. Some countries have experienced, tragically, much higher death rates than ours.
Can she confirm that more than 2 million New Zealanders over the age of 12 are yet to receive a single dose of the COVID vaccine?
Mr. Speaker, what I can confirm is that we have 2,290,143 people who have had at least one dose. That represents 54% of people aged 12 and over, acknowledging that that eligibility changed only recently. But what I think is also demonstrates just the pace of this rollout at this point are also not only those who have been vaccinated, but those who have now booked in to be vaccinated in the near future. We see, for instance, 68% of people aged 12 plus are booked or who have been vaccinated with at least one dose, 68%. That's fantastic, given only today you will have seen that we've just opened up eligibility for everyone. And again, as I say, demonstrates the pace that we're now at with our rollout.
So can she confirm that that leaves more than 2 million New Zealanders over the age of 12 who are yet to receive a single dose of the COVID vaccine?
Mr. Speaker, I've shared the numbers that I have. I'm not willing to on the spot verify the members' numbers.
Can she rule out having to delay vaccine appointments that have already been booked due to an anticipated shortage of vaccines?
Mr. Speaker, actually, that is incorrect. It is not that we have had a shortage of vaccines. It's that we've put in additional surge capacity to allow a considerable increase in vaccinations. Through this period that we're in now and leading into over September, we'd always planned around the supply that we had, which would have enabled us to, on average, deliver about 50,000 doses a day or 350,000 across the course of the week. When the outbreak started, we saw, of course, as you may expect, some demand lift, and we decided to then increase the capacity to provide surge vaccinations. That has led to over 500,000 doses being delivered a week, Mr. Speaker. What we're now seeking to do is meet that additional demand by seeking additional supply. Our goal, if we are unable to do that, is as much as possible maintain the bookings that we have, but also in those areas where there is big surges in demand and it is particularly high needs for us to vaccinate, keeping those additional surge capacity in Auckland and the Upper North Island.
Can the Prime Minister confirm if the additional vaccines that she's just referred to, if she has a date for when they will arrive?
Mr. Speaker, I can say that we're working in earnest across a number of different strategies. When we have more detail that I'm willing to share, we will absolutely share it. But as I say, we're already thinking in advance of if, in the eventuality, we're unable to meet that extra demand, what would we would do around the existing supply that we have. Keep in mind, we've of course always had deliveries coming in of Pfizer on a weekly basis, but they've been in the order of 300,000 when we are currently seeing demand of over 500,000, demand that we have helped create by putting in extra surge capacity.
Was the Director General of Health correct when he said, quote, "We're looking at every opportunity there is to see if we can get any to get some additional vaccine in," end quote. If so, is this additional vaccine needed to meet existing vaccine bookings?
Mr. Speaker, you'll have seen I just set out in quite some detail around what we had around existing planned supply versus the demand that we're seeing. And I also just set out in my answer to the question to the member that if we are unable to secure that extra supply, that our goal is to retain bookings. So I believe I've tried to comprehensively answer the member's question. And so therefore, yes, I do agree with Dr. Bloomfield's statements.
So why did it take an outbreak of COVID for the government to attempt to speed up the vaccine rollout?
Mr. Speaker, again, we have been working as quickly as we could against the supply that we had. We've always said that it is in the latter part of the year, particularly October, where we're finally seeing those large drops of vaccine to enable us to then scale up in a significant way. Even then, our projections were roughly 50,000 doses a day. But when we had the outbreak occur, we provided additional opportunities to vaccinate New Zealanders, and then we've sought to then increase supply. It's wrong to imply, though, that we don't have enough vaccines for every New Zealander. We do. They just happen to be arriving in several weeks' time, and we want to take the opportunity now, when demand is now, to try and vaccinate as many as we can.
So can we take it from the Prime Minister's comments today that we don't have enough supply actually in New Zealand at this stage to meet all of the existing vaccine bookings?
No, the member is incorrect. We currently have 726,000 doses in the country, and we receive them weekly. So, of course, at any given point, we're always receiving doses in order to meet the demand that we have at any given time. We have a surge, Mr. Speaker, because we've enabled a surge. People have been in high demand, and we're providing for it. The one other thing that I'd just point out to the member, there's been a significant implication in some of her interviews this morning that we wouldn't be experiencing Delta cases had we had a rollout that had started before, for instance, clinical trials had finished, which is what has happened in some countries. In some countries, they started vaccinating before clinical trials were even completed. We weren't one of those countries. Some of those countries, Mr. Speaker, are still experiencing outbreaks as significant as what they had before their vaccine rollouts, and that's because not enough people have been vaccinated. Our goal has to be to do better than even those who started some months ago. And we have that ability as a country. We all just need to continue to encourage people to take up the chance to be vaccinated.
Why wasn't consideration given to having a surge in vaccinations before the country ended up in a level 4 lockdown?
Mr. Speaker, of course, a surge is created by those who are willing to be vaccinated at any given time, firstly. Secondly, as I've said, in a matter of 3 to 4 weeks, that supply issue starts to diminish because we have a considerable increase in the supply that is before us, a considerable increase. So our rollout has always been one that has scaled up. But we took the opportunity as soon as this outbreak arrived, as soon as we had people in lockdown, where the only things they could do was be tested or vaccinated, to offer those vaccines, and we've done that. And it's not too dissimilar to what we've seen in other countries. However, we have beaten other countries per capita increase in vaccines being offered by almost every single measure. There's only one country who's had more at the peak of their vaccination rollouts. So the demand really has been globally unprecedented here in New Zealand.
Question number two, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by her statement regarding an alert level change in Auckland that, quote, we need to be confident we don't have Delta circulating undetected in the community, and we need to be confident any cases we may have are contained and isolated, end quote? If so, is this the same for the South Island?
Mr. Speaker, yes and yes. It is essential that we have confidence that there's no undetected transmission in our community. This is true for the South Island, as it is for Auckland, as it is for any other part of the country. There is just no margin of error with Delta, a lesson many jurisdictions have unfortunately learnt the hard way, which I've repeatedly said that level three is a watch and wait level. It's a crucial insurance policy. If there's something we've missed, despite our high levels of testing and wastewater sampling, we can surround it quickly, contain it and isolate it. And I would rather be in a level three environment to discover that than a level two environment, which would be a major setback.
Supplementary. Does the Prime Minister have any idea how devastating that so-called watch and wait level is for businesses and people going about their personal lives, their education, and in some cases even seeking healthcare in the South Island?
Speaker, yes, but I also know that prolonged lockdowns and outbreaks that become uncontrolled are even more devastating.
How many contacts have been identified in the South Island? And are any of them still awaiting a test result?
Mr. Speaker, 518 and yes.
How many are still awaiting a test result?
Mr. Speaker, a small handful are not due their day 12 tests, but I would caution the member that those are the contacts we know about. When you have over 400 locations of interest, and when you have over 30,000 contacts, you, of course, do everything you can to ensure that you have all of them, but it may well be the case that we didn't. Now, we have extra assurances, surveillance testing, wastewater testing, but I would much rather be on the side of caution to discover that we had potentially got something wrong than be in the position of being in a level two environment where essentially things go back to a much more normal status and discover a case, because that would mean potentially yo-yoing back into a level four, and that would be devastating.
How is it possible that the government still has not traced and tested only 518 contacts in the entire South Island after 15 days of high-level restrictions? And what does that say for the future of New Zealand's strategy?
Mr. Speaker, the member completely misunderstands the answer. We have. They have been tested. Some are not due to return second tests. So the member misunderstands. So the system has worked well. But what the member also misinterprets is the idea that when you have a situation where over the course of a week, from the time of arrival to the time of detection of case A, and over 400 locations of interest, that we have absolute confidence that we have every single individual who is at one of those locations of interest. Now, an enormous job has been done, and I pay tribute to those involved. Over 1,000 contact tracers alone involved in this situation and people in our call centres. But I would rather be cautious, and there will be some who disagree with that, but if we find a case in the South Island, we have the potential and the ability to contain it at this level. It would be much harder if we were free of restrictions.
Question number three, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, how did this government prepare DHBs for a Delta variant outbreak from when Delta was first detected in New Zealand 5 months ago, and which DHBs, if any, had low PPE inventory 8 days before the current Delta outbreak was discovered?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand's overall response to COVID-19 has been designed for all parts of the health system to be constantly prepared to respond to an outbreak at any moment. And that, of course, takes into account the latest insights into new variants of the virus that may emerge. This level of preparedness also involves all DHBs having adequate supplies of PPE on an ongoing basis. The distribution of PPE to DHBs and to primary care providers is managed centrally by the Ministry of Health, which has sufficient stock and quantity of PPE so that we have the capacity to respond to situations such as an outbreak or hospitalisation scenarios. The process for accessing PPE and other critical supplies from the Ministry's central supply are well understood, and the Ministry of Health engages once a week with procurement, logistics and supply chain leads from each of the district health boards. I've been advised that all DHBs have good stock on hand across all categories of PPE, and that no health facility is waiting more than 7 days to get a PPE order filled, and the vast majority of them are being filled within 3 days.
Supplementary. Can he confirm that no new ICU bed spaces have been added to DHBs since the start of April, when Delta was first detected at MIQ? And if not, how many have been added?
Mr Speaker, the number of ICU beds has remained around the same, although our ability to surge in terms of the number of people who require ventilation, for example, has improved significantly. One of the key issues around ICU capacity is workforce, and it isn't possible necessarily to scale up the ICU workforce in a very short space of time, although every effort is made to do so.
Supplementary. When he says the ICU bed spaces have remained the same since Delta first crossed our shores, is that effectively saying there has been no new ICU bed spaces?
Mr Speaker, first of all, I think it's important to note that Delta is still a relatively new variant, but our overall level of preparedness for a COVID-19 outbreak, regardless of Delta or not, has continued to improve. That's included looking at things like oxygen supplies, dealing with some of the capital investment required to ensure better oxygen supplies in our hospitals. It's included things like making sure we've got more ventilators available. I think from memory, about double the number of ventilators available now compared to when the outbreak began, compared to when the global pandemic began, I should say. Ongoing work has been taken place. There is, of course, and we should all acknowledge this, there continues to be a workforce constraint around our ability to respond to COVID-19. We are asking a lot of our health workforce. We have been for the last year and a half, and I think all New Zealanders are very grateful for their contribution.
Supplementary. How many additional ventilators then, if any, have been purchased since the start of April when Delta was first detected in MIQ?
Mr Speaker, the member is obsessing around Delta. The overall issue is we have been dealing with COVID-19 for a year and a half. The virus has continued to mutate, and we have continued to make preparations to deal with any outbreak of COVID-19, regardless of the variant of COVID-19 that we have been dealing with. So Delta has not changed the game at all in that regard. It has, of course, increased our awareness of the increased speed with which the virus can transmit. It's had some implications for how we think about MIQ and our border settings and so on. But in terms of our health system preparedness, we have been working to ensure that our health system is prepared to respond to any outbreak of COVID-19.
Supplementary. Why, according to answers to written questions, 8 days before the current Delta outbreak began, did Bay of Plenty DHB only have 280 N95 masks in its inventory compared to Mid-Central, which had more than 50,000? And how many days would 280 N95 masks last for?
Mr Speaker, in terms of the DHB by DHB breakdown, as I indicated, DHBs are responsible for ordering from the central store when their stocks start to become low. Those orders are being fulfilled very quickly. And where there is a need to ship urgent PPE in the event that a DHB has a sudden need for it, we have provision in place to be able to do that as well. But the overall responsibility for maintaining their stocks of PPE sits with individual district health boards. So the member would be best to direct his question to that particular DHB.
Supplementary. Why is Auckland Hospital now doing urgent infection control building work in the middle of an outbreak, and why wasn't this work done before we had an outbreak?
Mr Speaker, work is happening around the clock throughout the year on infection and prevention and control and upgrading hospital capital, and that has been happening since this government took office. We of course acknowledge that we inherited a very, very run-down health system.
Question number four, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Is he satisfied that all initiatives funded from the COVID-19 Response and Recovery Fund are for COVID-19 Response and Recovery? and that had the COVID-19 outbreak not occurred last year, they would not have been funded.
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am satisfied that they are supporting the response and recovery, bearing in mind that decisions on funding have been made at different times over the past 18 months in light of the circumstances at that time. In answer to the second part of the question, that is entirely hypothetical, as COVID-19 did occur last year.
To the Minister, does he think it's responsible fiscal management to use the cover of the COVID fund to initiate substantial new government spending over and above the published budget allowances on non-COVID projects?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I reject various parts of the premises of that question. What I would say to the member is that over the last 18 months, New Zealand has experienced the greatest economic shock in a century. Therefore, as a country and as a government, we have had to respond to that in a variety of ways. That includes both immediate response but also recovery measures to ensure that the New Zealand economy continues to work well. And the good news, Mr. Speaker, is that it has relative to the rest of the world.
Why did the $710 million for Three Waters reform need to be funded from the COVID Response and Recovery Fund?
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure the member opposite is aware of the parlous state of water infrastructure right around New Zealand. That decision was made as part of an important part of ensuring confidence and certainty for our construction sector to know that there would be projects there for them. He needs to bear in mind that throughout 2020 there were significant concerns that both the horizontal and vertical construction sectors would struggle to operate in a post-COVID environment. That was an area where the government was able to kill two birds with one stone, address a long-standing issue, and also give certainty to the construction companies that would be involved in the work.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Supplementary to the Minister, would the government have been in a stronger position to respond to the current outbreak if the balance of the COVID-19 response and recovery fund had been spent on tax cuts and roads?
Mr. Speaker, no, we would not. And when the proposal was made in August and September last year to spend billions of dollars on tax cuts and pet transport projects, that was a proposal that particular group of people wanted to make. That was their priority. We have our priorities.
How is an art documentary based on Papua New Guinea tattoo practice and revival COVID-related?
Well, Mr. Speaker, it's interesting that the member opposite would rather that the arts and creative sector in New Zealand withered away in the face of COVID. Providing support to our artists and our creatives to be able to get through COVID when many of the opportunities they had to generate income were taken away by COVID-19 is an extremely responsible thing to do. It is quite clear the member and his party do not care for the artists and creatives of New Zealand. We do.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Can the Finance Minister confirm that a significant proportion of the business financial assistance provided through the COVID-19 Relief and Recovery Fund has gone to fund things that aren't directly related to the COVID-19 response?
Well, indeed, Mr. Speaker, what we have done is ensured that businesses in New Zealand have cash flow and they have confidence that they are able to plan, that they are able to develop their businesses. This is a fund that has served New Zealand incredibly well. We have an economy that is operating at pre-COVID levels, which only a handful of other countries can claim, and we have unemployment down at 4%. The CRRF has been an important part of making sure that our economy has recovered.
Well, in light of that, to the Minister, if all of those projects have merit, why weren't they subject to the normal budget process rather than funded from the COVID Response Fund?
Mr. Speaker, they were subject to budget processes such as looking at their value for money, such as assessing them against the living standards framework. In some cases, there were situations where funding was required urgently in order to be able to address specific needs, but I'm sure the member would understand that that is what is required in a pandemic. Everything has been appropriated properly through the processes of this Parliament.
Question number five, Chris Bishop.
Sorry, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 Response, is he satisfied with the speed of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout and decisions relating to the rollout made by the government to this point?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I would note that as supplies of vaccine have arrived in New Zealand, they have been administered incredibly efficiently. We have about a 99.5% vaccine utilisation rate, one of the highest in the world. Our booking system has operated effectively, and the supply chain and logistics around the campaign, the vaccine campaign, have operated very, very well. 3.5 million doses overall have been delivered to date. Our overall weekly delivery has scaled up significantly in recent weeks as supply has allowed. 54% of our eligible population aged 12 years and over have now received at least one dose of the vaccine, a significant milestone. We're working hard to keep up that momentum.
Has the government approached any other governments in order to seek COVID-19 vaccines from them for New Zealand? And if so, what countries and what types of vaccine?
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister and I have both indicated publicly that we are exploring a range of different avenues to increase our supply of vaccine through September. Through October, we're confident that we have enough vaccines due to be shipped from Pfizer to be able to more than meet the demand that we have. But September, we are looking to see if we can increase the overall supplies of that. I certainly don't believe it's in the public interest to start naming any countries or any potential partners at this point. However, I would indicate that we remain committed to a Pfizer vaccine rollout.
Is it government policy to, quote, vaccinate as many people as possible as quickly as possible, as the Prime Minister said yesterday? And if so, is he satisfied with New Zealand having the second slowest rollout in the developed world?
Mr. Speaker, of course I would like to vaccinate more people faster. Supply has been the big constraint up until mid-July, and there's a potential that supply will be a constraint through September, given the huge volume, the huge surge in demand that we are currently seeing, which I welcome, Mr. Speaker. I would note that of those age cohorts that have been eligible for longer, we're seeing very, very high uptake, up to 85% in the 65-plus category. I think that sets a standard for the rest of the age cohorts across New Zealand to try and catch up. And I certainly would encourage them to book in. Would I have liked to have seen more vaccines arrive in the country faster? Yes, of course I would have. Do I regret, though, making the decision to switch to a Pfizer a campaign based around using only the Pfizer vaccine? No, I don't. I do believe that in the next period of time, that will prove to have been a good decision for New Zealand. It has meant, however, that we weren't able to vaccinate as many people in the first part of the year as we might have liked.
Why are only approximately 80% of rest home workers vaccinated? And is the government considering making it mandatory for rest home workers to be vaccinated to work in a rest home?
Mr. Speaker, obviously I would like to see that number higher. Rest home workers have had access to the vaccine longer than most New Zealanders have. It is not compulsory for them, but we certainly have provided a lot of opportunities for them to take up the chance to be vaccinated, and I would like to see a higher proportion of them doing so.
Why is the government not planning on vaccinating students in schools until next year, when there are many weeks left in the school year and 12 to 16-year-olds can now be vaccinated?
Mr. Speaker, the feedback that we've had overall is that many families are preferring to bring their children with them when they get vaccinated, so take a family-based vaccination approach, rather than having the children and the parents vaccinated at separate dates at separate times. So that is certainly what we have been working towards. I wouldn't rule out the potential for school sites to be used in the future, but I would note that in terms of administering as many vaccines as fast as possible, school sites aren't necessarily the most efficient way to do that. We're talking about a relatively small number of people. Even if you include the teachers and the kids, it's still a relatively small number of people. So you'd be standing up new vaccination sites all of the time only to vaccinate a relatively small number. The focus up to this point where we're standing up new vaccination sites has been trying to stand up sites that can have as large a throughput as possible so that we can make the best use of the vaccination workforce.
Supplementary. Why has the New Zealand government still not ordered any booster shots of vaccines when many other countries have ordered hundreds of millions of doses and the US will start doing booster shots this month?
Hi, Mr. Speaker. I note that only one country so far has actually started to administer booster shots, and that's Israel. In terms of whether we have supplies to do booster shots, we already have enough orders of vaccine coming in order to start a booster campaign, and it would be well into next year before we needed to have additional supplies in order to service a third rollout of vaccine to New Zealanders. So we already have several vaccines. We already have several million vaccines that will be available to start a booster shot campaign. If we decide to do that. But again, I would note that we'll follow the science on that rather than the marketing of the pharmaceutical companies.
Question number six, the Honourable James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Will the government make further funding available from the COVID-19 Response and Recovery Fund to support people in hardship? And if so, in what form?
Mr. Speaker, in short, yes, as we assess the extent of the adequacy of current responses and any emerging needs. In a longer form, as long as the Speaker lets me speak for a little bit longer, we are going to continue the work that we've done to support those on low incomes. Most notably, you would have seen this with the increase to all main benefits that was in the budget this year, and the ongoing work that we have done with the Ministry of Social Development, and most recently the announcements by Ministers Cipollone and Henare about additional support around matters of food security.
Does he agree with the Minister for Social Development and Employment regarding additional support, that the government is, quote, watching this space, end quote, and if so, what is the government watching for before it decides to make further support available for those who need it?
Well, Mr. Speaker, as I said in my primary answer, what we want to do is ensure that the current forms of support we have are adequate. Where they are not and where we either need to top up existing funds or create new ones, that is the work that we are doing at the moment. I would encourage anybody who is suffering any form of hardship to get in contact with the Ministry of Social Development. We have provided additional resources just within the last week for MSD around issues of food security in particular, and we will continue to look at other areas of hardship.
In light of that answer, would things like hardship grants and food grants be necessary if more funding had been available in Budget 2021 to increase core benefits by a greater amount?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that the increase in benefits that was in Budget 2021 represented the largest in a generation. It was a significant shift for those people on the lowest incomes in New Zealand and came on top of earlier increases in that space and also further support through the winter energy payment. As I said earlier on, we will continue to look to provide support to those who are in the greatest need, and we will have more to say on that, I'm sure, in the coming days.
Well, in light of that answer, Mr. Speaker, given the quantums of funding that was made available, why then are there still people who are having to approach services for food parcels and hardship grants?
Well, Mr. Speaker, there are New Zealanders in a wide range of need for a wide range of reasons. We do understand that not always is that met through the formal income support system. That is why we strongly encourage those who are experiencing hardship, who need support, to contact the Ministry of Social Development. Funding has been given to MSD and to other social service providers to be able to respond to emergency need.
Will he make funding available for financial support for tertiary students to cover their rent, particularly those who can't access student allowances and don't have the usual kinds of casual employment options available to them at the moment?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I would note that the hardship fund for learners was extended this year and does continue to be available for the 2021 calendar year through tertiary institutions. We again are continuing to monitor that and the use of that closely.
The Honourable Penny Hinara.
Can the Minister of Finance confirm that Budget 2020 provided provision for whānau order to continue to support whānau, and in the most recent outbreak, they've pivoted those resources to do such things?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I can confirm that. I want to thank again whānau order providers, other iwi providers and other social service providers for their excellent work. It is a very good question that the member asks, because the funding that was given out both in Budget 2020 and in Budget 2021 doesn't stop, it carries on. And I congratulate the whānau order providers for using that and pivoting to these new circumstances.
Will he make funding available to help stranded migrant workers in Aotearoa cover living costs like rent, and now that emergency benefits have ended, so that they don't have to rely on food parcels?
Mr. Speaker, the government's taking significant steps to support those people who we would put into that category of stranded migrants. And I note that the Assistance for Foreign Nationals Impacted by COVID-19 program has assisted 12,794 temporary visa holders at a total cost of $26.5 million. I'm advised that there is only between 60 and 80 people who were left being supported by that program. Again, I would encourage them to talk to local social service agencies.
And will he make funding available for people like early childhood relief teachers, many of whom are not eligible for current financial support despite not being able to work right now?
Mr. Speaker, for those early, the difficulty we have here is those people who are in those circumstances not employed by the government. So the schemes that the government has in place to support relief teachers are through direct means are not available. Those centres that they work for are continuing to be funded. And so the first port of call for those relief teachers should be a conversation with the centre for which they work for. Depending on their own employment situation, they may well be eligible in their own right for support through the Wage Subsidy Scheme and Resurgence Support Scheme. And I'd encourage those relief teachers to look at those two schemes as well.
That concludes oral questions.